Hey guys, it's Kiff with a quick note about this week's episode. We had some technical challenges emerge near the end of our conversation, and unfortunately, a bit of it got snipped out. That's why it feels like it ends so abruptly. But I had a marvelous conversation with Vanessa, and hopefully I'll be able to bring her back on the show, and we can talk some more, because she was just a spectacular guest with some wonderful insights and stuff. And even with this slightly smaller version, there's still so many wonderful things that you'll be able to glean out of it. So please enjoy. Thanks. It's just live to tape.
Got it. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, oh my God, and the music played that. It's like a radio station. That's awesome.
No, that's crazy.
Groovy.
Hey, what's up, Welcome back to another episode of All Over VoiceOver Kiff VH. I'm your host, Kiff VH. With me in studio, at long last, the lovely, the talented Vanessa Marshall. Vanessa, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
We were just talking, like, the first time I think we met was, I want to say 2010 at Pat Fraley's workshop.
That's right. He had me come in and guest speak, which was an honor. And I got to meet a bunch of cool people.
Oh, man. Yeah. How long have you known Pat?
Oh, boy. Well, I've been doing voiceover since 1997. So I think I've known him since the very beginning. We were both at CESD.
Okay.
I took a bunch of his classes and started working more regularly, like around 2000.
Okay.
And then by 2010, he had me come and guest speak at his class, which was like bananas.
A trip.
Yeah, completely.
That's so awesome.
Yeah.
Is that, that's when you started doing VO, was in like 90s? How did you?
1997.
Well, let me go even like further back. Like where are you from?
I'm from Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
Was born and raised here. My mom, her name's Joan Van Ark. She was on Knott's Landing in Dallas. And my dad, my dad was a news reporter at KNBC over in Burbank.
Uh-huh.
So they were in the entertainment business. So I sort of grew up in it. And they needed someone to portray my mom as a little girl on Knott's Landing. So I got my SAG card. I think it was like 1980. The director came up to me and he said, "If you cry, I will give you a Big Mac." So they said, and action. And I was sobbing and cut. And the whole, you know, the set was clapping. She's a star. I'm just hungry. But and I totally got a Big Mac. It was amazing. That was my first gig.
That's
and,
awesome.
Then I ended up going to Princeton in New Jersey.
Okay.
Majored in English, very nearly majored in anthropology, religion. I was really into theater and storytelling.
Uh-huh.
And how sacred it is. That's really my deal. Like I love healing through storytelling. And ended up focusing on literature and those elements within, you know, anything and everything ever written. That was my goal, was to read it and ultimately to hopefully write. Then ended up, a good friend of mine had to do a scene for NYU Graduate School for acting, a master's in acting at Tisch. And 2,000 people applied, 20 got in. He did not, and I did.
What?
Yeah, and I—
So you apply, you were already—
Well, I was his scene partner.
Okay.
And I didn't know what I was going to do after graduating Princeton.
Uh-huh.
I knew I wanted to do something in terms of storytelling, but that could have been in the theater. I actually applied to Yale Drama School for directing.
Uh-huh.
They told me to age 20 years. I was like, thanks a lot.
What?
Yeah, I guess they think you're not old enough to understand some of the basic elements of the human experience. Sure, why not? But when I got into NYU Graduate School to get a master's in acting, I thought, well, maybe I'll do this. Luckily, this person who did not get in is doing quite well. His name is Matt Rausch. He was on Banshee, and now I believe he's on Madam Secretary and other thing. I mean, he's absolutely brilliant. A good buddy from Princeton. And
awesome.
So anyway, I have him to thank for my master's degree in acting. But we studied dialects there and all the great work, you know, Shakespeare and, you know, I was Masha. I played all the crazy roles there. Came out back home to Los Angeles and was doing stand-up comedy, sketch comedy, and
What led? I'm sorry to interrupt. Mm-hmm. What led you into stand up and sketch comedy after sort of a very classical?
I was classically trained and did Commedia dell'arte and mask work and all these very noble things. However, when I came to Los Angeles and I was signed with J. Michael Bloom and would go out on these auditions, no one cared. Huh. And what seemed to matter was what I looked like. And at the time, I was about 205 pounds. I'm now about 135, thanks to boxing. I practiced martial arts and I just, my body changed completely. I became more athletic. But I was sort of the fat, funny girl, and there wasn't a lot of love for that type of person at that time, sort of the late 90s. It was still very much that anorexic, gaunt thing that was popular, and I was like a little too spunky to be the sidekick. I had a lot of fire in me, so they didn't really know what to do with me. So I said, I know what to do. I'm going to grab a microphone, and I'm going to start telling the truth about what I see. And started doing stand-up. And I, every time I tell stories, I do voices and characters to explain, you know, just how brilliant someone said something or whatever it was. How are you going to grasp that unless I imitate them?
Right.
Which can also be confused as schmacting.
Yeah.
Or driving people crazy, like, you know, oh, you're one of those actor types. But it's literally how I convey stories. But Kathy Lizzio at CESD is my godfather's sister. Stay with me.
Okay.
CESD, TJ Escott is the E in CESD, and his sister is Kathy Lizzio, who's an animation agent there. And she came to see one of my one-woman shows that I did. I did several of them, but one of them I played 20 different characters.
Oh, wow.
And she said, you know, maybe you should try animation. And I said, yeah, well, what does that look like? And she said, a ton of classes, but why don't you come in and read? Uh-huh. And that was in 1997. I came in, and I think you could actually hear my heart beating on the microphone. I mean, like the blood through the veins in my neck. I was so scared. You know, you can hear like Vanessa Marshall. Because what is this thing in front of my face? I didn't know what I was doing at all.
Right. Well, especially if your background has been so much and the perception too of this work, let alone like Hollywood, but like working with a mic,
what the heck? Yeah.
Yeah.
I had no idea. And basically my read sucked. The commercial copy, this and that. But then at the end of it, CESD, when you go in there, they tell you to do like 20 different characters or do character voices. And I had prepared different jokes for each voice. And I just went bananas. And her jaw dropped. And that's why they signed me. They didn't sign me because my reads were any good. They signed me because they could tell that I had just enough something that maybe I would book for being, I don't know, some might say nuts, but but there was just something, there was something worth pursuing. And at that time it was less competitive than it is now. And technology hadn't afforded everyone the ability to record at home at that point. So it was a very happy accident. They signed me in 97. I took a bajillion classes. And I loved all of them. I loved learning. And to me, the commercial copy is like 30-second stories. And as I said, I love telling stories. So I felt really creatively engaged, so much so that when I had a part on Scrubs, I was in the pilot and it was Nurse Becky. She was, you know, I was like, I've arrived. And unfortunately, the episodes kept running long and I kept waiting in the dressing room to go work. And my agent said, you know, I've got 80 Culligan tags for you to do and you're sitting there aging in the trailer, you need to make a decision.
Yeah.
You know, what are you doing? And I chose voiceover. So now I don't pursue on-camera acting at all. I do write a bunch. I'm working on a novel and a couple other show ideas. And that keeps me creatively engaged. But so I think I started working steadily like 98, 99. I'm not sure exactly, but there were a million classes between that initial meeting at CESD and booking those jobs. And it's just been wonderful ever since. So that's kind of my deal.
That's awesome. What things from – oh, man. It's a wonderful table of contents. So there's stuff I want to
like, I know. Yeah,
come back
a
and
lot.
Revisit.
Sorry,
and stuff.
Gave
no,
you,
no,
gave you
that's
a lot
awesome.
There.
That's great. What? Well, why do you think – the storytelling aspect has been so important to you. That's something that I keep hearing you coming through, not only from your undergrad, but like
Yeah, I guess I'm an only child, and the pursuit of the meaning of life and one's place in it, individuating from one's family, is something that really intrigues me. That you know, this idea of going from your family of origin to the family of man, like that's why I think I'm such a huge Star Wars fan. Is Joseph Campbell talks about these elements of myth, and George Lucas is a huge fan of that, and so those things have always really deeply impacted me. And my family was very religious, and that story felt often outside of myself, but I could appreciate the sacred nature of it and its intention. And to me, I found that stories in the theater were more sacred than they were theatrical. And this is why I wanted to major in anthropology, is because there's something really cool about Haitian voodoo ritual, right? It's very theatrical, but it's intensely spiritual.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you look at some of the Catholic religions, some of those, you know, the frankincense and all those things are very showy. But I felt like there's this hunger that we all have as a culture to come together, whether it's, you know, football teams or, you know, on the dark side, there maybe, you know, other things that bring people together.
Yeah.
But I've always been curious about those things and sort of trying to figure out who I am and why I'm here and how I can be a better a part of humanity. And so to me, I feel so satisfied when I go see a great film that deals with those topics. And in turn, sometimes the existential crisis of the wrong toothpaste can, you know, equally a commercial can be as healing for me. I don't know. You know what I mean? Like they're that's why I say they're all fascinating and engaging. And maybe it's because my dad, being the news reporter that he was always questing for the truth on behalf of, you know, American citizens to report it to them so they could vote responsibly. And then my mom is like meta theatrical. I mean, oh my goodness, you know, on a soap opera for 13 years, like it's, it gets intense, guys. It gets intense. Everything is really like and scene. But being the genetic amalgamation of those two kinds of humans, that maybe I am this sort of journalistic performer who is seeking some kind of truth, you know, and I think maybe that curiosity is probably just born out of living with the two of them for the first part of my life.
That's so fascinating. I completely relate to that.
Cool.
That compulsion to tell stories any kind and the in particular the sort of spiritual I'm Catholic, but I converted to Catholicism. I was raised Protestant. I converted just so, you know, Sherry and I could sit in the same pew on Sundays.
It
didn't make any sense to me to be like, what, the doctrine of transubstantiation?
Yeah.
We can't. No.
It
doesn't make any sense to me. So, but what keeps me engaged in that is the ritual aspect of it.
Yeah, and, that's interesting.
And that feeling of, you can, even as things change in all different kinds of places, there's some kind of like keyframe that exists that you can, you know.
A core thing.
Yeah.
I am fascinated by religions and I did almost major in religion at one point, again, because it feels like it's important. And it, strangely, most of my friends are atheists. So I'm an intensely spiritual person. But I think one of the things that I learned growing up was that if I'm intolerant of other people's religions, I'm equally as, you know, judgmental.
Yeah.
And so I really can be quick to see where someone else's worldview is right for them.
Yeah.
But all of it is interesting to me. And my roommate was a philosophy major and she was amazing. Her brain is like fascinating also. But so I landed in the stand-up and the sketch world. And then I found that a lot of the people who do well in voiceover are either stand-up comics. I feel like they have a worldview that exists without apology, and they sort of bring that to the copy. It may be completely inappropriate, but at least you respect them.
And it's a strong, committed point of view
totally.
That you've crafted either in front of an audience or driving around or wherever.
You know, Dennis Leary. I mean, some of these people, they come to the mic, and it doesn't matter they know who you are, which I think allows the listener to relax and believe them. You know, whereas similarly, I find people who have a singing background, they also, there's something that they have with the maybe the musicality of the text that they can tell the story of the copy through, you know, their musical sort of phrasing and whatever that background is, that that is effortless and it's not contrived or effortful in the moment. It's actually just beautiful.
But
I mean, I'm sure there are a million other kinds of people who do well in voiceover, but in my experience, I've noticed that some with musical backgrounds and stand-up backgrounds tend to kind of like drop the mic.
Yeah, right. Well, it's cool because, I mean, I it's what I love about like, I don't know, in particular, like a piece of commercial copy with no specs. It's like it's a blank check in a way.
It is.
You know, and it invites you to totally come to it as you are, and whether your background is music or politics or conviction or
I've been
this is a sidebar. I've been teaching this intro class at Second City.
And, oh, cool.
And it's a blast. And it's kind of like, I feel like Richard Attenborough in Jurassic Park going, welcome to Jurassic Park. This is voiceover. There's audiobooks over there.
Oh, that's cool.
But I ran across this woman named Sally Hogshead who has...
Great name.
Isn't it?
Brilliant.
And she's in advertising.
That's awesome.
She's written a book called How the World Sees You.
Whoa.
And her thought process, at least how I've applied it to voiceover, is... the job of a commercial spot, among many other things, ultimately is just to fascinate, to make the listener stop and go, huh. And sometimes that's it, right?
Yeah.
So she identifies seven ways in which we fascinate. She calls them our fascination advantages. And it's like passion, mystique, trust, power, and then kind of extrapolates on each of them.
Wow.
And then the idea that I've been trying to play with is, a lot of times when you're in the booth and someone is like, let's do it again, but talk like you're talking to your best friend.
Yeah.
That's not playable.
No.
If you get an action like, give me more trust, make me make me believe you or believe the copy more or be passionate or hold back, that those kind of verbs are more intrinsically tied to those flavors.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So that's, I've been messing with that and it's been kind of interesting to make that discovery.
Yeah, that's been one of the most confounding directions, I think, is talk like you're talking to your friend and the copy is, you know, Sprockets or $3.99 this week.
Right.
I don't generally pick up the phone and say, yo, dude, Sprockets, my man. Like, no, we don't generally discuss price points, but I get their point and it, and really it is, I think when I was doing legal copy and they'd say, okay, you need to do it faster, I would imagine that my listener was running out of the room so that I would speak faster, not because I had to speak faster, but because they were leaving. And that would motivate me in an organic way to speak more quickly and articulately, but because my listener's leaving, not because I need to speak faster.
That's amazing.
It helped a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you then suddenly can do it.
Yeah.
Without worrying if you're fast enough. Or see, but that's what I'm saying. It's like if you're worrying that you're not really speaking to your friend, like they say, speak to one person. It's like, well, what was I going to talk to a congregation? Like, yeah, no, I know, dude. But it's I don't want it to sound affected, you know?
Yeah.
Like, or too comfortable. A lot of times for women, they want these specs that are sort of like stand-up comedy vibes. And the danger with that is, there can be something somewhat mean or alienating about a female who doesn't care, if you will.
Huh.
It's a fine line between the way I finally came to it was, it's like I'm inviting someone to a nightclub, but they will get in. It's exclusive and I know about it, but you're not going to wait in line and be humiliated. Like, you can actually get in.
Right.
You know what I mean? So that's kind of it's exclusive and I don't care, but I still, like, you're still welcome. You know?
That's so great. It's so important.
But these nuances, they help. You're right, because some things are not playable.
Right. And we're often given, I mean, it completely dovetails into what you were talking about before. I don't know if dovetails is the right verb, but I'll use it. The way you talked about at the outset about the importance of story, and that sometimes when you're given nothing – and you're given the gift of needing to create a story for it, even if the story is something that is outside of your experience or outside of something that you even care about.
Yeah.
That you have to find your way through the ability to making it something that you care about, or at least sound like you do.
Yeah. The specificity, I think, always helps. When I book something and I ask myself, like, what was it about that that was so different? It's usually heightened specificity, that there's, whether it's an animated role, I was imitating someone I know, but see, I made a choice.
Yeah.
Oh, that character's very much like so-and-so. Well, I know how that person thinks. I know what they're like when they're mad, blah, blah, blah. I have complete confidence in that, and I think, oh, well, that's probably why I booked that. And, you know, applying sort of a socio-political situation to a scene or something like that that may not necessarily be in the language of it, that at least it's specific, that has also helped. But again, it's almost like I had said, Dennis Leary, you listen to him and you know he's okay, so you can relax and take in what he's saying.
Yeah.
Similarly, I think the specificity affords the listener, like, oh, well, she must know what she's talking about. No, what is she saying? Yeah.
Right.
They actually listen, which I guess is, like you're saying, the ability to fascinate. If you stop worrying that someone's, you know, if you hear their veins on the mic, you're not going to hear what they're saying. So in other words, the place I started, I didn't have any of this whatsoever. But
you come from a place of that's the other component, too, is you come from a place of confidence of like, you know,
ultimately,
expertise, or not even necessarily an expert on, you know, I'm enough of an expert to get you into the club.
Right.
You know,
exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. But it's such a fine balance.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it really
is. And like the tuning of your story and how well you understand the story of what's going on. You might have a really specific, let's say like a Jeep campaign, and it's about America.
Yeah,
and then like, America. What's America? Yeah. We got to like, but like, but it can't, but it's like, great, but it's right now, my story is too specifically Southern Eastern. So how can I still appeal to Washington State and middle of Michigan?
Sure.
You know, without, and it's, I don't know, it feels really, it's weird. Like, it's so esoteric every kind of way. I think sorry, word of time you come to it.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
I think they want celebrities a lot of time because they know who they are.
Hmm.
So, you know, one of the people that I studied with, Maurice Tobias, she used to call it a star read. Give it a star read. And what a star read is that no one else is going to read it the way, you know, William Shatner will or whatever it is. But like, if one could imagine oneself as a celebrity, all right, well, you're going to do your read and you're a well-known commodity, you're a celebrity, do you on the mic. And giving ourselves permission to be, you know, Jane Fonda or whatever it is, you know, no disrespect to Jane, but he's like, please. You know. But at the same time, really just speaking without apology, I think that's why they want to hire them, apart from the fact that a lot of times I think they just want to play golf with them or say that they've worked with them. Yeah. I've heard that said. But I think why they give prototypes of celebrities is that, again, they know who they are.
Yes.
So, you know, anytime we can give ourselves permission to do the same, I think it helps fascinate, like you said. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I totally agree. That's great. What are some of the lessons that you got during your millions of classes that you took from over the course? And like, I mean, I remember running into you at a class when we moved out here at Hope Levy's workshop.
Oh yeah,
and like,
Hope
and
stuff has been great. Yeah,
I'm so grateful for that. It was the first time I met Lindsay.
Yeah.
And like just to be able to go into that space and meet people and just get great.
Yeah, those are the kind of tune-up things that I still do. I love those. When I started, I did Kalmanson. I took an animation class with Gray Delisle, actually. It was our first class. And so we sort of started around the same time. And that was fantastic. I took the Stephen Tobolowsky improv class.
Oh, yeah.
That
over was great. At Kalmanson's.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And then I started studying with Maurice Tobias. I did a commercial demo, and we studied promo and narration and radio liners. I also do imaging stuff.
Great.
And her class, I mean, you really need to take it once in your lifetime. It's so fascinating what she teaches and how she really does give us permission to be who we are at the microphone, and how her, the way she gets you there is really, I mean, they call her the voice whisperer for a reason, you know. But that really laid a solid foundation, I think. And since then, I also took animation classes with Chris Zimmerman, Charlie Adler, Andrea Romano. And I more recently have studied with Jody Gottlieb for promo, and she's been wonderful.
Awesome.
And Jeff Howell has been amazing.
Oh, love Jeff.
Yeah, their workshops. Jody has a timing workshop that is really, really helpful.
Really?
Yeah.
What does that mean? Like trying to get a 5-second read?
Well, what you do in the class is you do actual promos to time and with the beeps, and you get a sense of the high pressure situation of, let's say, being on the line with CBS, and you know, you get the 3 beeps, and then you have to launch into the promo, and you're only hearing the audio. They've got the spot on their end, and it's just it's almost like doing high intensity workout training. And being relaxed and able to, you know, get the tags in time. And because I think when you don't, you don't necessarily want to learn on the job. You know, it's a great way. I was the voice of Big Brother, and I was the voice of more recently ABC Family, which became Freeform. And I know that a lot of the stuff that I did with Jody, really the sort of calisthenics of the work that we did in those workshops, gave me the confidence to, when I went in for a callback for those things, I had no fear whatsoever and felt completely relaxed. And so, you know, she's really had a huge impact, and she's done my promo demos and narration. And I think I did a sports demo. I was doing, I was the voice of the X Games for several years. Yeah. And we put together a sports demo to try and, you know, do more in that world. I'm a huge sports fan. I love football, boxing, hockey. I'm such an athlete. It's weird.
Awesome.
I was deadlifting my body weight this morning going,
"That's amazing.
Who is this?" I mean, like I said, I was 205 pounds. Like, I could eat my body weight, but I didn't know that I could lift it. I've just changed so much. It's weird.
What was
the shift?
Yeah. What was the catalyst for that?
You know,
that's too,
it's
know
a crazy. No, it's a. Oh no worries whatsoever. It's pretty hilarious. I had just gotten back from New York. I had my master's degree in acting, and I was ready to crush Los Angeles.
Yeah,
but I was 225 or 205 pounds, and so life had other plans for me. And I was at a party at J. Michael Bloom's house, and a guy came up to me as I was clearing the buffet table, and he said, "You know, you really should model." And I looked at him, and I had some choice words in my mind for him, like, you know, but I think I said, "What, with clay?" You know, because I'm not there were anorexics everywhere, you know, no offense to anorexics, but like, my body type was not like, you wouldn't look at a 205-pound lady and go, "Whoa, there's a model." But it turns out he was a Ford plus-size modeling agency guy who worked with J. Michael Bloom.
Uh-huh.
And I got signed at Ford Modeling Agency, and I flew up to San Francisco for my first job. I don't mean to be crass and talk numbers, but just deal with me for 1 second.
Of course.
They gave me $1,200 to wear what they called, you know, plus size clothing, which was like, they were pup tents. Like, anyone would have looked massive in these. And I didn't care, especially coming from my comedy background. I was like, bring it on. Bring me that tent.
Yeah.
And I did this gig, and none of the skinny models ate any of the food. I got to clear that buffet table. And I just felt like I found my people. Like, this is the coolest thing I've ever heard of in my entire life. And I met the women in the plus size modeling field. They were one of them. I mean, I made new friends, and I found beauty in my size, and I accepted myself, and I stopped wanting to be as thin. My mom's a size 0 and runs like 17 miles a day still.
Wow.
And on Knott's Landing, you know, she was a size 0 and was rewarded dually for that. And I just could not ever. I love food. It's never my deal.
Mm-hmm.
And, so I just kind of gave up in the best way possible, which is to say that I accepted myself as a large and lovely woman. I was actually on the cover of BBW, which is Big Beautiful Woman. Not even kidding. But I love sports, and I'm a huge athlete. And then I discovered boxing, and I started losing weight. So my theatrical agent was happy. Uh-huh. My modeling agent was pissed off.
Yeah.
Like, what are you doing? Going to the gym? And then my regular agent was like, oh, what are you doing? You going to the gym?
Uh-huh.
You know, so it was this sort of schizophrenia of like, you know, again, sort of wow. another impasse. Like, do you want to be on camera or what are you doing? But I trusted that my body was going to naturally land where it needed to. So since about 1998, I've lost around 70 pounds, I would say. I'm 135. And it's very, very slowly over time. But I think this is where my body wants to be. And trust me, I eat a lot. But I just sort of surrendered to that process. And you can't really model. Believe me, I tried. I actually had a whole fat suit that I would bring to these jobs that there are these pads. That
is it like a silicone pad?
No. Well, the there are these massive cutlet things that you put in your boobs that are that make you look fantastic. I found those. I mean, it's amazing.
So you would wear that to cover. You were losing the weight, and
yeah.
But your modeling agent is still getting you out, and you're like,
oh. I won. Donnie and Marie had a talk show at one point, and I show up. And they're like, oh, you're in the maternity outfit. I was like, wait, but I've never birthed any. Like, what? And they're like, go to the couch and grab a pillow. What? So I go and I shove this thing in my gut and I wore the maternity. And I sort of, being the schmactor that I am, I was like hobbling around like, oh, my back. Oh, you know, like, whatever. Just, I see my friends who are pregnant, you know, their feet hurt. I don't know. Right. And then Donnie was like, how far along are you? And I didn't want to lie. I love Donnie. I'm a little bit rock and roll. Like, and I just screamed out any minute, and then everyone laughed, and then I waddled off. I don't know how it's just then like on the news, I was a pear shaped body in the morning, you know. I don't know how these things happen. It's like I was struggling to maintain my title as a BBW. But, you know, eventually we had to have that sort of heart to heart and say, you know, Vanessa, you're now like a size 6'8" and you're just not a plus size and you're not thin enough to do the other stuff. So go to the gym and do you. And that's how that happened. But but anyway, the novel that I'm writing is all about this and all about what it's like to grow up the daughter of someone who, you know, followed all the rules of the 80s.
Yeah.
And, you know, she embodied all those ideals and was rewarded for them. But I got caught sort of in the 90s where it was sort of a transition period. You know, today you have Mike and Molly and you have all these people who are celebrated for exactly who they are. And it's beautiful. It just wasn't the case when I was coming up.
Yeah.
But it was an interesting journey to come to where I am today. And I'm pretty jolly about the whole thing. But I think the main message of the book is to sort of foster self-acceptance and that sometimes paradoxically there's a miracle on the other side of that and total
fantastic.
Freedom. Yeah. Because I see a lot of women still, even though, you know, many people are accepted at any size today, I still see a lot of women hating the wrong person and being really cruel to themselves. And those habits die hard. It's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard to just, you know, look at someone's muffin top, or, I mean, my own, and go like, yeah, that's lovely. It's like, oh, man.
Yeah.
But I think at a certain point, there are greater, more sort of difficult issues in the world. You know, people have lost their homes in the fires and this and that. Like, one's body weight is not that important, but it can be a source of agony.
Yeah.
And so hopefully my book will help some women love and accept themselves and give them permission to be, you know, exactly who they are and discover what happens on the other side of that.
I'm really moved by your approach and discovery and the transformation that you've experienced. And I grew up with my mother has always been overweight and significantly so.
Oh,
and
really?
And over, I want to say 2 years ago, I did the Whole Life Challenge with George Whittam.
Oh, nice.
And I just watched the transformation in him. And I was like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
How are you?
Yeah.
And I started doing what he was doing and started noticing a transformation in my own body, sure, and then pass that on to my mother. Aww. And then she's lost over 75 pounds by That's transforming. Awesome.
That's great.
Yeah. And
I mean, not that there's anything wrong with being 70 pounds heavier. I mean, at right. a certain point, it's a health issue. I don't know that I was ever unhealthy. That's why I said I just sort of gave up trying to control the whole thing and yeah. trusted that my body would land where it was meant to.
Yeah.
And, you know, everyone... no one can tell anyone what they should eat, or, you know, everybody's different.
Sure, of course.
But if people feel great and they feel empowered at that weight, groovy. If they feel upset about it, you know, there are things you can do.
Right.
And if they make those changes and then they feel empowered and fantastic, that's really, that's why I love going to the gym. I see people change every day. It's really inspiring. You know,
that's awesome.
Yeah, Thanksgiving. I was just such a champ. I mean, I put it away. So, you know, it's no one's perfect. But
we did turducken this year.
Oh, I love you. That's awesome.
With jambalaya packed into it. Unreal. It was amazing.
You win. That's brilliant.
Yeah, it was pretty
great. I love it.
I love how the breadth of the things that you're pursuing in voiceover work. I know that people in particular, I mean, because of your experience working on Star Wars with Rebels, and that I imagine you can get put into a box associated with one character or one line or something.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there's it's what it is. Mm-hmm. But it's inspiring to me to hear just the breadth and width and the variety of the work that comprises your experience and the necessity for that too, you know?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. There are so many different genres, to work in. Yeah. For a long time, I was, not that active in animation. It took about 10 years for that to land for me.
What was that process? Well, I mean,
it was taking a lot of classes and auditioning and sort of waiting my turn. Uh-huh. They're sort of like the folks that work a lot, and you know, they don't need another lead female. They've got that covered.
Uh-huh.
So I was, you know, various parts. I played Irwin. My first role that I ever got was Irwin on The Grim Adventures of Billy and Mandy. And he's an African-American boy, of all things. So gender, racial lines. And I didn't know, they never mentioned his race.
Yeah.
And everyone else, I guess they caught that the kid was African-American. I did not know that. And they did sort of urban reads that are very stereotypical, and if not insulting. And I just read him like a little boy. And that's why I got the part.
Huh.
When I saw the cartoon, I thought like, oh, wow, okay. I don't read...
Wow.
Copy for roles that are for anyone of color, because I feel like there are so many Caucasian roles, it's just not cool.
Yeah.
Personally. So I probably wouldn't have read it if I'd known.
Yeah.
you know, that was fascinating. And then trying to remember which other ones, I don't know, I just guessed it on a bunch of things. Like I was Coral Lipstick Lady number one on Justice League, and a bunch of weird things on Scooby-Doo. And eventually, I think it was like 2014, 13, the Star Wars thing came along, and then Guardians of the Galaxy came along. And so I was playing two green women in space or female alien races.
Yeah.
You know, I'd been doing Young Justice, and I was... Mary Jane on Spectacular Spider-Man. And so they're, you know, and Wonder Woman and a couple of the straight-to-DVD things for Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
It all just sort of started happening. I was really grateful for that. And in the meantime, I had already built up the base of doing a bunch of radio stations, the imaging gigs that I have in Dubai, Kenya, all over the place.
What a trip.
And... yeah, and then the promo stuff, for whatever reason, I'm able to, if you tell me you need something in 3.2 seconds, I don't know how, but I have like an inner clock and I can do that. So promo came easy to me, or I don't know if it came easily, but it was something that I enjoyed doing.
I love that challenge too, that internal clock of like, and a lot of times a producer will say, I need it faster. I'm like, tell me exactly how.
Exactly. Isn't that weird?
Give me a number.
Isn't that weird if they tell you the times in between, like that was 4.6, that was 3.1, and they need 3.2, and you can do it on the third one when you are given the time. I don't know what that is.
I think we have a much more innate sense of that.
I don't know, man. I don't know.
Than people assume. I think, you know, really, and maybe it's, I mean, I don't know. I love that feeling.
I love it too.
Especially when they're like 4.0.
Yeah, 4.0. Yeah.
4.1.
Yeah. It's so good. Yeah.
Such a good feeling.
But yeah, so, you know, in the commercial world, there's on the one hand the ability to nonchalantly tell someone the good news as if you're speaking to a friend. And then there's sort of the retail genre of being able to be jolly about the price points and put that sparkle and pizzazz on free, but not sounding manipulative or corny.
Or you're desperate.
Yeah.
So that's why it's free for you.
Yeah. Like, or any, like, yeah.
It's great.
Yeah. And then, of course, there's legal tags. That's sort of another thing. One area that I haven't worked that much in is narration. I booked a bunch of stuff for E! There was a time I knew a bunch of the producers over there. I mean, having booked jobs and worked for them, and they would keep hiring me after they hired me once, or I didn't know them otherwise. But I don't usually get the narration gigs.
It's a weird style. I did one show for Investigation Discovery.
Yeah,
called Disappeared, and it was like
not so much.
It was like there's been a couple audiobooks where I get to a chunk and then hit this kind of emotional place where I'll read a line and then need to compose myself and then need another. And this story, I mean, Disappeared was exactly like that too, of these really tragic tales.
Yeah. I don't read on some of the like bodies were buried in the, I can't deal with that.
It's a lot.
I don't know. It's scary.
Yeah,
I'm trying to believe that people are good, and I believe this is my personal belief, but I think this is why story is interesting.
Yeah.
But I think people are born good. Some stuff happens to them, or there's a biochemical thing in the brain that creates like a sociopath or something like that. But the acts that we see at the tail end of that story are not necessarily that person. That person was harmed somewhere, and that breaks my heart.
Yeah.
You know, that was the best they could do after whatever wicked thing befell them. It breaks my heart. I mean, not to digress into Star Wars, but that's why Darth Vader's character is so interesting to me, is because he used to scare me to death as a child. And as I've learned more about him and, his losing his mom and trying to save his wife and all of the things that would make him turn to the dark side, that he was so desperate not to be abandoned and loved, that he would, do the wrong thing. That's an interesting story.
I agree.
But it's just some of the serial killer narration things. I'm just like, you know what? I am not strong enough to deal with that.
I hear you.
Maybe that's why I don't work so much, because most of them are
most
pretty
of them
gross.
That most of that. It's a hearty meal. It's interesting. I love. Like you, we're just like, because of The Last Jedi being released this week, and Spike or whatever channels have been running the Star Wars, like everything constantly.
Yeah.
And I mean, my dad took me to see Star Wars in 1977 on my eighth birthday. So it's always been a part of my life.
Yeah, same here.
And like that, when Revenge of the Sith came out, it like was like this missing puzzle piece that turned the entire saga into something in my mind called the tragedy of Darth Vader.
Totally.
And his journey from born good to born and and gone through this journey of trying and then like And the cool part of how, like, how Clone Wars inserted into that storytelling and making it more robust in the books. My wife is massively interested in Timothy Zahn's books, all that stuff. Yeah.
I met him. I wept.
Did you really?
I totally wept. I lost it. Yeah. Completely like, blah. Yeah. I just, you can ask him. I was on the floor. Yeah. Yeah.
It's just such a complete and powerful.
Yeah.
Experience.
Yeah.
What am I?
So universal.
So there you go. There's my conversation with Vanessa Marshall. Sorry for the abrupt out. But as I mentioned at the top, that's what it is. So yeah. Listen, thanks so much for joining me. You guys have been such a tremendous blessing to me personally. And as I reflect on the coming year, I'm excited for more conversations and more growth and more inspiration and everything that goes along with each of these episodes. So thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk to you on the next one. Peace.
This has been All Over VoiceOver with Kiff VH. For questions to be either answered on Twitter or on an upcoming cast, tweet to the show at AllOverVOKiff. Till next week, you get what you get and don't get upset. Claim victory and depart the field.